by saying, I'm not so sure it's stupidity, but, you know, given the stakes, absolute insanity, it's difficult to try to read the mind of a crazy person, but trying to predict the behavior of a collective of sociopathy and worse that currently makes policy in the West is both frightening and unfortunately impossible, at least for me.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Activist and commentator Don DeBar joining us from Austin in New York, and independent international affairs analyst Gilbert Doctorow joining us from Brussels. Special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now, we enlighten you with verses 40 to 43 of chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. يا بني إسرائيل اذكروا نعمتي التي أنعمت عليكم وأوفوا بعهدي أوف بعهدكم وأوفوا بعهدي أوف بعهدكم وإياي فارهبون وآمنوا بما أنزلت مصدقا لما معكم ولا تكونوا أول كافر به ولا تشتروا بآياتي ثمنا قليلا وإياي فاتقون ولا تلبسوا الحق بالباطل وتكتموا الحق وأنتم تعلمون. وأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واركعوا مع الراكعين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. O children of Israel, call to mind my favor which I bestowed on you, and be faithful to your covenant with me. I will fulfill my covenant with you, and of me, me alone, should you be afraid. And believe in what I have revealed, verifying that which is with you, and be not the first to deny it, neither take a mean price in exchange for my communications, and me, me alone should you fear. And do not mix up the truth with the falsehood, nor hide the truth while you know it. And keep up prayer, and pay the poor rate, and bow down with those who bow down.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: thousands of protesters take to the streets in Berlin and London to call for an end to Western weapons supply to Ukraine. Thousands of people rally in the Portuguese capital Lisbon to demand better living conditions amid the cost of living crisis. And vote counting is underway in Nigeria's presidential election, with three candidates seen as frontrunners to succeed President Buhari. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Thousands of protesters in the German capital Berlin demonstrate against supplying Ukraine with weapons for war with Russia. The protesters call on the German government to stop the escalation and instead engage in negotiations with Moscow. The protests were held a day after the one-year anniversary of the war. Security was tight as police mobilized 1,400 officers to keep the peace and enforce bans on Russian and Soviet flags. Similar protests were also held in the British capital, London.
Stop the war! Stop the war!
Thousands of kilometers away from the front lines of the Russia-Ukraine war, an appeal for peace from central London.
What today's protest means that while there may be consensus at the official political level here in Britain and other European countries, anti-war sentiment among ordinary people is on the rise.
Years before the conflict began, anti-war campaigners had warned of the consequences of a NATO expansion to countries that shared borders with Russia. Their warnings were ignored.
The calls for it to go on and on, which is what all the governments are talking about now, is really a call for more of this and for an escalation of the war with the possible threat of nuclear wars.
Но нигде.
That threat became more real last week after Russian President Vladimir Putin announced his country was halting its participation in a nuclear arms reduction treaty with the U.S. A response to U.S.-led NATO nations sending tanks and other armaments to Ukraine. Wars come at a cost, and it's not just the Ukrainians and the Russians impacted by this one. The ripple effects of what's happening on the battlefield have already washed up on European shores.
But we are seeing an impact on fuel bills. We are seeing an impact on food prices. But I think also there is a growing cynicism that there's no money to pay nurses a decent pay rise. There's no money for the National Health Service, but the British government seems to have endless coffers of money to provide arms for Ukraine.
After a year of war that's seen tens of thousands killed, tens of millions displaced, and entire cities destroyed, will this renewed call for peace make a difference? Saeed Pourreza, London.
Earlier we talked to Peter Ford, the former British ambassador to Syria, on the anti-war protests in Britain. He said the majority of British people have been brainwashed by the wall-to-wall coverage of pro-war media.
The protests today were mainly on strategic grounds, people who just believe that it is wrong to join in conflict and to add to conflict, to pour oil on flames. People, and I attended one of the meetings myself in London, people are much more concerned about the dangers of escalation of this conflict, and they oppose American imperialism. But I have to be honest, it's only a very small minority in Britain who feel this way. The numbers attending the protests in London today were really very small, numbered in hundreds rather than thousands. I wish there were more, but I must be honest. Because the people have been brainwashed, frankly, by our media following the government line. The remarkable thing about this anniversary in Britain has been the continuous coverage for a week, almost 24 hours a day, non-stop propaganda pro-war. So it's no wonder that the people are brainwashed, and the majority of ordinary British people have no understanding of this conflict.
The European Union slaps a new round of hefty sanctions on Russia, vowing to increase pressure on Moscow until Ukraine is liberated. The EU foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell said the latest bans target Russia's banking sector and its access to technology used for military purposes. Other bans include tighter export restrictions on entities that support Russia's military-industrial complex. European Commission chief Ursula von der Leyen also said the sanctions are designed to deplete Russia's war arsenal and weaken its economy. The 10th round of sanctions were adopted on the first anniversary of the war in Ukraine. The U.S. and its allies have imposed a host of sanctions on Russia since the war began last February. Moscow has repeatedly said the sanctions have backfired and that Western countries have been hit worse by the bans. Thousands of people have taken to the streets of the Portuguese capital, Lisbon, to demand better living conditions amid the ongoing cost of living crisis. The protest was organized by Portugal's Fair Life movement, which was created by people who live in Lisbon's poorer outskirts. The demonstrators chanted slogans demanding higher wages and a cap on the price of essential goods and government action on housing. The demonstration came 2 weeks after tens of thousands of Portuguese teachers staged mass protests in Lisbon to demand higher wages and better working conditions. Portugal is one of Western Europe's poorest countries, which is struggling with a decades-high inflation. And thousands of people have hit the streets of Tel Aviv for the eighth straight week to denounce judicial reforms proposed by the new far-right Israeli cabinet. The protesters gathered in front of the Knesset waving flags and placards that read, "Crime Minister." The demonstration came days after the Israeli MPs took a step towards approving the controversial reforms. The plan has triggered protests with people hitting the streets for weeks to express their anger at what they call a fascist cabinet. They believe the proposed overhaul would fatally undermine checks and balances. If approved, the law would limit the powers of the top court to overturn the cabinet's decision. And following up with the 2020 blast in Lebanon, a high court in the United Kingdom has found a British company liable for the incident. We discussed this issue with our guests on our news review program.
Time now for the news review. A British court has ruled that a London-based company is liable for a deadly explosion that hit the Lebanese capital, Beirut, more than 2 years ago. The judgment by the High Court of Justice in London was issued after a lawsuit was filed against the British firm, Savara. There will be a further hearing to determine damages. The lawsuit was filed by lawyers from the Beirut Bar Association and families of some of the victims. They say that Savara is responsible for improper storage of chemicals at a Beirut port warehouse. Hundreds of tons of ammonium nitrate were stored, which detonated and caused a huge blast in August 2020. The incident took more than 200 lives. The latest ruling by the London court is regarded as an important step toward justice, as investigations into the incident had been impeded. Let's now get some more information to discuss this a bit. So allow me to invite a couple of guests. Mariam Salah, our correspondent, joining us from Beirut. Karim Sharar is a political analyst. He's also in Beirut. So Mariam, beginning with you, we just were talking about this maybe a couple of months ago, about this investigation that was impeded, and then the judicial officials that were blaming each other for this thing, and also Hezbollah's stance as we're talking together. So where did this come from? I know it's from Bar Association, but is this firm responsible for the whole thing, or there are more aspects to this?
Absolutely not. Of course, the beginning initiation of how the camel came to Beirut, that is probably the responsibility of this company. And this is probably maybe a ray of light for these of the victims. Very significant that we do start out from where these chemicals came from and were brought in and shipped and chartered. They were chartered in 2013 by this Savara company, but it's not the only one that is responsible. After it came in, who allowed it to be stored in a storage which is very much hazardous? Who allowed it to stay? You have the judges during the time. You have the politicians who were during that time that were, of course, responsible for this, for those, especially for those who knew about it. And that is one of the main issues and the questions that those who have against the current prosecutor, they are saying that he's not taking a look at those who did accept the storage of such chemicals in the Beirut port during that time. He's only focusing on those who were in power when the explosions went off in 2020. So that is one of the main questions that we have here. And that is why you have this judicial issue being very much impeded, being stopped. Many are accusing the current prosecutor of politicizing the entire case. And there are also issues, it seems, that it has become a tit for tat issue between the judges themselves, the prosecutors that are in the judicial court and faces the prosecutor of that is responsible for the Beirut port blast. So it also has in itself become politicized, in addition to the fact that the judges are not taking care of it as they should in a manner where you take a look at everyone who was responsible during that time and throughout those who were in power. So basically, yes, this could probably be something significant for recompensation when it comes to the families. However, when it comes to the true justice of how of those who allowed it to remain in Lebanon, that is something we're still waiting for.
Okay. Now, Karim Sharar, as Mariam just mentioned, that this is not the whole thing. So maybe the families are going to be compensated, but what should be done so that this case could be well looked into, see who or which entities or people have been responsible and which one is to blame to what degree? How could we make sure that justice will be served in this case?
Well, you're asking us, it's a somewhat difficult question because, like your correspondent said, everything in Lebanon or this investigation itself, it's been very much politicized ever since not just day one, hour one, because just after the blast occurred, I mean, a lot of people remember how fingers started to be pointed at the wrong people without any evidence whatsoever. I think fingers started to be pointed at the resistance without any evidence whatsoever. So you can see politicization for this file from day one. As for due process or if the investigation followed the appropriate procedure, well, that is also a resounding no, because the judge, as your correspondent said, has not been following the correct procedure. He's been targeting a select few, mainly those who were in power when the blast occurred. There are certain political parties or political figures who haven't been questioned at all, and if they were, it was merely out of formality.
Right. Okay. Thank you so much for that. Mariam Saleh, our correspondent, and Kerem Shahra, political analyst in Beirut, with their comments and contributions.
Vote counting begins in Nigeria's presidential and parliamentary elections. More than 90 million people were registered to vote in Africa's most populous nations. Three candidates are seen as the frontrunners to succeed President Muhammadu Buhari. Bola Tinubu and Atiku Abubakar represent the two dominant parties, but a surprise third candidate from the Labour Party is Peter Obi. The vote counting is expected to take several days, while a runoff election has been predicted. The contested poll was simultaneously held with the country's parliamentary elections. Nigerian elections have often been marred by violence and political and ethnic tensions. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps says it has developed a new cruise missile with a range of over 1,600 kilometers.
Our long-range cruise missile with 1,650 kilometers of range has been added to the Islamic Republic's missile arsenal. It's flying at an altitude of approximately 40 to 50 meters from the ground. It's a phenomenon that needs no further explanation, considering its 1,650 kilometer range.
General Hajizadeh said the missile is named after the city of Pave in the western Iranian province of Kermanshah to honor Iranian martyrs in that region. The commander of the IRGC's Aerospace Force also said Iran now possesses hypersonic missiles, which no air defense system may ever be able to intercept.
This missile system is capable of striking any target we want, and naturally our first targets will be the missile defense systems. And with our other technologies, such as cruise missiles and drones and other capabilities, they cannot compete with us in any way.
General Hajizadeh also said Iran is now able to hit American ships at a distance of 2,000 kilometers. Iran has made quick advancements in its missile program in recent years. The Islamic Republic, however, has repeatedly stressed that its missile program is purely defensive and meant for deterrence. North Korea has fired a number of missiles once again. Even though these missile tests have become a common occurrence this time around, it may be different. First off, it is reported that these are missiles that would carry a nuclear warhead. Since last year, North Korea has increased the number of its missile tests, which could be a warning sign for the U.S. and its allies in the region. North Korea first tested a long-range cruise missile system in September 2021 and has since described those weapons as strategic, implying that they are being developed with the intent to arm them with nuclear warheads. The U.S. has reacted by holding tabletop nuclear drills to stimulate a drill on attacking North Korea.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
World is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless.
A
Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Imam Sajjad and the Power of Prayers. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to the program. Today is the fifth of the blessed month of Sha'ban, the third successive day of joyousness. Yesterday and the day before, we celebrated the blessed birth anniversaries, respectively, of the valiant standard bearer of Karbala, Hazrat Abbas, peace upon him, and the immortal martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace upon him. While today, on the 5th of Sha'ban, we are basking the blessings of the birthday of the survivor of the heartrending tragedy of Karbala, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, also known as Sajjad, for his sincere acts of worship. Please stay with us for a special feature on the life and times of the great-grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. O Allah, bless Muhammad and the progeny of Muhammad, the ark faring through deep oceans. Those who embark it obtain safety, and those who forsake it are drowned. Those who try to get ahead of them leave the bounds of faith, and those who lag behind them perish, and those who attach themselves to them join their fold. O Allah, bless Muhammad and the progeny of Muhammad, the secure sanctuary, the aid of the distressed and the oppressed, the shelter of the refugees, and the asylum of those seeking haven. This is the month of your prophet, the chief of your prophets, Sha'ban, which you have enveloped in your mercy and your approval. The month wherein it was the practice of the Prophet of Allah. May Allah bless him and his progeny to observe until his death its fast and to perform devotions during its nights and days, in order to do it honor and reverence out of humility before you. O Allah, so help us in following his example with regard to it, and to make us deserving of his intercession in your court. What we recited to you were passages of the special supplication the faithful recite daily in the blessed month of Sha'ban. The wordings provide a glimpse of some of the innumerable merits of the Messenger of Mercy and his infallible progeny, the Ahlul Bayt, who are likened to the Ark of Prophet Noah. It means whoever boards this ark has attained salvation, and whoever lags behind is drowned. The difference is that Noah's ark was for a specific time and a limited period of history for saving monotheists of that particular era from the great deluge, while the Prophet of Islam and his Ahlul Bayt represent the eternal and universal ark of salvation, so that the seekers of truth are saved from drowning in the sea of ignorance and the oceans of unbelief in every age, generation, and geopolitical place. In other words, this immortal ark is made up of 14 flawless helmsmen, who are none other than the Prophet of Islam, his immaculate daughter Fatima Zahra, her husband, and the impeccable Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, their two infallible sons, the leaders of the youth of paradise, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, and the nine spotless imams of the lineage of Imam Hussein, peace upon them all. These peerless personalities steer humanity on the straight an unwavering path towards Allah the Exalted, and his promise of the everlasting bliss of paradise for the believers. This unique supplication was taught to us by one of these 14 helmsmen of the Ark of Salvation. He was the Prophet's great-grandson, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, who was born in Medina on the 5th of Sha'ban in the year 38 AH, corresponding to 659 AD. His father, the martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, named him Ali in honor of his own father, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. The mother of the fourth Imam was the virtuous Iranian lady, Shahrbanu, the princess of Iran. He was thus known as Ibnul Khiyaratain, or the son of two best persons, that is, the Hashemites among the Arabs and the Persians among the non-Arabs. Having lost his mother in childhood, he was brought up by his paternal aunt, the heroine of Karbala, Hazrat Zainab, peace upon her. As a 23-year-old youth, he was present in Karbala on the tragic 10th of Muharram, the fateful day of Ashura, but could not take part in the jihad because of being bedridden because of sickness. During the equally tragic aftermath of the tragedy of Karbala, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, along with the noble ladies and children of the Prophet's household, including his own 4-year-old son, the future Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, was taken in chains and fetters to the courts of the tyrants in Kufa and Damascus. In Syria, in the court of the godless Yazid, despite suffering the traumas of torture during the long journey from southern Iraq, he made the mission of his martyred father triumph in the enemy capital. His sermons shook the foundations of the Umayyad Caliphate and made Yazid release the noble captives. Here, we relate an incident that is indicative of the magnanimity of the fourth infallible heir of the Prophet. When Yazid, feigning regret at the tragedy of Karbala, asked whether God would forgive his misdeed in murdering the Prophet's grandson, the bereaved Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, as the divinely designated refuge of all those seeking asylum, even if it be an avowed enemy, replied, "Perform the Salatul Qufayla between the daily Maghrib and Isha obligatory ritual prayers. Perhaps the All-Merciful may have mercy upon you." The libertine and agnostic Yazid, however, was not destined to mend his evil ways and died in the state of sins, tyranny, and disbelief. Glory to the Lord Most High for placing his trust in secure places. The all-wise creator knew that just as Iblis, the demon Satan, had deprived himself of divine mercy by refusing to prostrate to the father of the human race, Adam, without the least regret, the agnostic and libertine Yazid, who was miserably trapped in Lucifer's snare to the extent of dismissing the concept of the Almighty Creator, the mission of prophets, and the revelation of heavenly scriptures would never have the time from his debaucheries to ever think of prayer or supplication. For the next 34 years, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, carried his novel jihad of grooming the seekers of truth through the medium of prayers and supplications, which survive till this day as eternal bezels of wisdom for the guidance of humanity. He faced a string of tyrants, including the torturous decade-long rule in Hejaz of the crafty criminal Abdullah ibn Zubayr, who had laid claim to the caliphate and subjected the prophet's Hashemite clan to acute oppression, including a failed plot to burn all male members alive. But never for a moment did the Imam spare any effort to guide Muslims. Among the immortal legacies of the fourth Imam is the Risalatul Huquq, or the Treatise of Rights, that is more perfect than the United Nations Charter of Human Rights, and the Sahifatu Sajjadiyya, which is a manual of supplications to God in highly eloquent words that contain every topic under the sun, including scientific issues and the weight of light, something which modern science is still beginning to discover. When we study the supplications of Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, we find that he used them as means to educate others about the oneness of Allah, the angels, and all Islamic concepts in the various fields of life, including science. It is a pity that these supplications have not been studied thoroughly even among the followers of Ahlul Bayt, or in the academic institutions that study the spiritual side of Islam. We hope that groundbreaking research will take place in this regard, especially in the seminaries and universities. Here we present to you some interesting glimpses from the Risalatul Huquq. The greatest right upon you is from Allah Himself, and this is the root of all other rights. The greatest right of Allah upon you is to worship Him without associating anything with Him. If you do that with purity of heart, He promises to give you sufficiently what you need here and in the next world. The rights of your teacher upon you are: you should look at Him with honor, listen to Him with full attention, sit facing Him with respect, and do not raise your voice in His presence. If someone asks Him a question, you should not reply it, but let the teacher do it. You should overlook His shortcomings and speak of His good qualities. Keep away from His enemies, and do not make enemies of His friends. If you do all these, angels will be your witness that you did what you were required to do and that you obtained knowledge from Him for the pleasure of Allah only. The rights of your mother are: she carried you where no one carries anyone else. She fed you the fruit of your heart, which no one gives to anyone else. She protected you with all parts of her body. She did not care if she remained hungry as long as you were fed, if she was thirsty as long as you drank, if she had no proper clothes as long you had clothes on, if she was in the sun so long as you were in shade. She lost her sleep for you, She protected you from cold and heat so that you should live. You will never be able to thank her unless if Allah helps you. The right of your neighbor is that you should guard him in his absence, show respect to him in his presence, and help him when he is wronged. Do not do any shameful act to him. If you know of any improper things about him, keep that secret. If you know he will accept your advice, then give it to him. Do not leave him alone when he is in trouble. Help him out of his troubles. Forgive him if he has wronged you and treat him generously.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a news story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today, we're going to take a look at the lessons we can learn from the life of one of the most prominent and impactful Muslims to have ever lived in the West, Malcolm X. Malcolm was brutally gunned down in February 1965, but his journey from non-Muslim criminal to one of the loudest and most eloquent Muslim voices in the face of US racism and oppression still inspires millions of Muslims worldwide today.
On February 21st, 1965, Malcolm X was gunned down whilst preparing to give a speech in New York City's Audubon Ballroom. The killing brought to a premature end one of the most inspirational revolutionary careers the world had ever known. Malcolm X is mostly renowned as a political figure of huge significance across the black and Muslim world for his tireless efforts to confront and combat racism, imperialism, and global injustice.
The history of unpunished violence against our people clearly indicates that we must be prepared to defend ourselves, or we will continue to be a defenseless people at the mercy of a ruthless and violent racist mob.
Born Malcolm Little in the U.S. state of Nebraska in 1925, his early childhood was marred by the murder of his father by white racists. In his teens, he eventually ended up in New York City. There, he spiraled into a life of crime, which ended in his arrest for burglary in 1946. Whilst in jail, Malcolm studied a variety of ideologies, eventually adopting the black nationalism of the Nation of Islam, a group he joined upon his release in 1952, rising through the ranks to minister and spokesperson. His fiery, passionate speeches against American racism garnered him popularity. He also urged the black community to become educated, strong, and self-sustainable. Eventually, Malcolm outgrew the Nation of Islam, and after performing the Hajj pilgrimage in 1964, embraced traditional Islam. Malcolm X was amongst the early voices to criticize the U.S. war on Vietnam. During the same period, he became a significant figure in advancing civil rights with his rhetorical power proving his greatest asset. Three black men were arrested for Malcolm X's assassination, two of them not at the shooting scene that day. Decades on, the legacy of Malcolm X remains strong. His family and millions of followers still doubt the police investigation, wondering whether his real killers were let go by bigger powers.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about the life of Malcolm X is Ahmed Hussein from Muslim advocacy group MPAC UK, which has held up Malcolm X as a role model for Muslims in the West, and Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, who joins us on Skype. He's a Muslim scholar and lecturer based here in the UK. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Ahmed, I'm going to come straight to you on this and just ask, obviously you guys have pushed the legacy of Malcolm X and a lot of the work that you do. Just tell me, why is Malcolm X such an important role model for Muslims in the West?
Sure. It's because he was so able to articulately explain how a community of people, obviously he was first talking about the black people in America, but his thoughts on how people can free themselves of oppression is still a blueprint for ourselves in the Muslim world today. Basically, he understood that that freedom comes from resilience in a community. It's not a case of people saying, "Oh, if we can get rid of such and such a political leader, such and such political party coming in," that isn't enough to reach that strength, to reach that resilience. It has to come from oneself and from one's community. And so when you listen in on his speeches, when you read his letters and you read his autobiography, you realize that what he's telling people to do is to have a sense of pride in who they are. And obviously as Muslims, and in his later time as a Orthodox Muslim himself, that means in ourselves as Muslims, in our identity and in Islam as a religion. Particularly when he was saying that America needs to understand Islam. We could actually flip that over in the modern context. Muslims need to understand Islam better, whereas Malcolm X saw in Islam and the Muslim community of his time a force for overcoming racism and division and the answers to the social ills of the Americas at the time. We as Muslims, we need to understand that Islam is inherently a force for good and a force for change. And until we understand that, like Malcolm X did, we will remain in this state of oppression that we are in today.
For sure. Now, Sheikh, let me come to you and bring you in on this discussion. Now, tell me, how did Malcolm X inspire you personally?
How Malcolm X has influenced me to even become a Muslim is because of the fact that Malcolm X saw Islam not only as the final truth, but also, when I say the final truth, I mean the final revelation of the truth that has been occurring throughout the ages. But also he saw Islam as a liberation theology. If we are aware of the struggle for justice of African Americans and Africans in the diaspora, we know that their oppression is a totalistic one. It is not just merely an economic or a social or a cultural type of revolution, but it is also a revolution in terms of our image of the divine, or our understanding, I would rather say, of the divine.
Well, that is indeed fascinating. And Ahmed, I'm going to come back to you because you mentioned some interesting points earlier about the fact that the Muslim community is in a state of oppression right now. tell me, how can we compare Malcolm X to the type of community leadership that we have in the Muslim community today? It seems as if perhaps we're lacking some of that fiery, hard-hitting passion that Malcolm X was so famous for.
And I think passion is the word for it. He really understood that racism, that divisiveness, was destroying not just American society, but the very lives of the people around him that he saw. And that is what really drove him. That is what drove him in terms of his drive for unity. And that is something that our Muslim leaders need to realize. Islam in itself is intrinsically about unity and justice. And, you know, unfortunately, we see too many imams, you know, in the UK context, I can speak very candidly about. Unfortunately, in the UK context, we have too many mosque leaders who see their mosques as an opportunity to run some kind of social club on ethnic lines. And it's not just about unity. Our mosque leaders, our Muslim leaders, are just so small-minded. We shouldn't forget that the last few years of Malcolm X's life was spent in doing a tour of Africa and other black nations. Why? Because he wants to internationalize the cause that was so important to him. Mm-hmm. Racism in the US, he realized, needed to become internationalized because he wanted to push it as a priority, as something that needs to be resolved through the UN. So our Muslim leaders today, not only are they divisive, they're just too small-minded. And that's why, as a community, we are so riddled with issues.
For sure. Now, before we carry on this discussion, gentlemen, Malcolm X, of course, was very renowned for his fiery oratory, and some of his speeches have gone down among the most memorable and quotable of all time. Let's play out some of Malcolm X at his best.
Because nothing in our book, the Quran, as you call it, Koran, teaches us to suffer peacefully. Our religion teaches us to be intelligent, be peaceful, be courteous, obey the law, respect everyone. But if someone puts his hand on you, send him to the cemetery. That's a good religion. In fact, that's that old-time religion. That's the one that Ma and Pa used to talk about. An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, and a head for a head, and a life for a life. That's a good religion. And then anybody, no one resents that kind of religion being taught but a wolf who intends to make you his meal.
The police the same way. They put their club upside your head and then turn around and accuse you of attacking them. Every case of police brutality against a Negro follows the same pattern. They attack you, bust you all upside your mouth, and then take you to court and charge you with assault. What kind of democracy is that? What kind of freedom is that? What kind of social or political system is it when a black man has no voice in court, has nothing on his side other than what the white man chooses to give him? My brothers and sisters, we have to put a stop to this, and it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves.
Well, known as a black nationalist for most of his career, towards the end of his short life, Malcolm embraced Orthodox Islam, influenced by the Hajj pilgrimage he took in 1964. Whilst in the holy city of Mecca, he wrote a powerful letter to colleagues back in New York. Here are some of the extracts.
America needs to understand Islam, because this is the one religion that erases from its society the race problem. Throughout my travels in the Muslim world, I have met, talked to, and even eaten with people who in America would have been considered white. But the white attitude was removed from their minds by the religion of Islam. I have never before seen sincere and true brotherhood practiced by all colors together, irrespective of their color. During the past 11 days here in the Muslim world, I have eaten from the same plate, drunk from the same glass, and slept on the same rug while praying to the same God with fellow Muslims whose eyes were the bluest of the blue, whose hair was the blondest of the blonde, and whose skin was the whitest of white. And in the words and in the deeds of the white Muslims, I felt the same sincerity that I felt amongst the black African Muslims of Nigeria, Sudan, and Ghana. We were all truly the same brothers, because their belief in one God had removed the white from their minds, the white from their behavior, and the white from their attitude.
I'm going to go straight to Sheikh Ahmed Hanif once again and bring you in on this discussion. Now, Sheikh, tell me about this part of Malcolm X's great life. Obviously, we know about the days mostly when he was identified as a black nationalist, when he served with the Nation. But what about the fact that he became an Orthodox Muslim later in life? What about Malcolm the Muslim?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to separate the issue of black nationalism. We have to know what he meant by that. And we have to separate that from a black counter-racism, you see. I think in terms of the black counter-racism, which goes back to the ideology of the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad, you know, despite what the error of this, it was quite a liberating thing for the African American. And the reason why is because the white supremacist establishment painted the world in a kind of an evolutionist type of a way, where it saw the darker races of mankind as inferior and the white races of mankind as you know, superior. And what Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam did was they flipped that around, and they basically said, you know, who is the person who was guilty of the most oppression and the most killing and the most genocide and so forth? And if there's anybody who was supposed to be a devil, it wasn't a black man, but it was a white man. Of course, you can see how liberating that was. You know, it's like, for example, you know, many of the, let's say, third world or what's so-called third world countries, how they look at America, for example, and Europe. You know, they all emulate Europe, they all emulate America because they believe that, quote unquote, they are the most advanced nations in the world. And by virtue of that fact, or that illusion, they find themselves under the foot of these organizations, of these countries. And so therefore, when one flips the switch on them and say, no, these are the most, let's say, for example, in an extreme sense, the most depraved countries in the world, it kind of changes that psychological orientation. What he meant by black nationalism is that, look, black people should not be expecting their oppressor to give them rights. Black people should take their rights. And one of the ways that you can take your right is to be self-sufficient, is to not spend your money trying to whiten your skin and straighten your hair and color your hair and putting on colored contact lenses and dancing the night away. You know, that what black people should do is pool the economic resources to be economically independent in the United States of America or in the world as possible with justice. And so they will be able to stand up on their own two feet and fight international oppression, you know, on their own. And so by the time he ended up going to Hajj, what he realized is that Muslims or Islam was not a racist religion. In fact, that he saw Muslims, as he describes it in his autobiography, whose skin was the whitest of white, whose eyes were the bluest of blue. And when you ask them about their race, they would say, well, yeah, I'm white, but it's white as a kind of, you know, one of those phenomena, you know, that describes them. That's all, you see. He said, it's different when a white man calls himself white in America. You know, it means that I'm superior. I'm the boss. And with this experience among the Muslims, he realized that, you know, this ideology of the Nation of Islam was wrong. And he came back to America with a message that was now also potent for white people to get involved.
Ahmed, I'm going to bring you in again on this. Now, obviously, Malcolm X, outspoken, he wasn't afraid of anyone. I mean, what a man he truly was. We certainly miss him now. But Do you think that there is just a real problem here of Muslims just being too scared to speak out? Perhaps they're too worried about their job security, their financial stability. Malcolm X prioritized his community first and foremost and his beliefs.
Yeah, he prioritized justice. And he's described racism as the most explosive and pernicious evil. And so when you've got a view of an injustice like that, the passion for justice is inevitable, and that is what drove him. And so we have to question ourselves, what is our driving force in life? Is it justice? Is it even Islam? Or is it, as you said, is it our job security? Is it our comfort in our life? Because the thing is, and yet again, you know, why is Malcolm X still relevant to our lives, you know, so many decades on? Just a few weeks ago, in the UK context, just a few weeks ago, there was a report going into the counter-extremism strategy called Prevent. And what it basically detailed, you know, there's loads of interesting quotes in there. One of them is that, you know, quote-unquote Islamists use Islam as a way to define their political and moral judgments. Well, yeah, that's what every Muslim does. And yet, so what we're seeing here in the UK modern context and across the West as well, we're seeing a criminalization of Islam. And just like in Malcolm X's time, we saw the black man, the black woman, the black community being vilified, being denigrated, being satirized, and then that hatred became internalized. Likewise, we're seeing that happen with the Muslim community today as well. We are getting so used to seeing ourselves through the lens of those who want to control us that we see ourselves as suspicious. We see our behaviors as suspicious. Mm. We see, oh, we got to be more careful than the non-Muslim next door. Well, the words that we say, the tone with which we speak.
One of the things Malcolm X spoke about, one of his most famous speeches, was the house. I guess we would say house Muslim in our case.
Field Muslim, yeah.
Yeah, field Muslim, that type of thing. What do you make of that? It still rings true today, surely.
That speaks to the effectiveness of propaganda. We've internalized some.